Both the surface and groundwater, but I don't know, and they will tell us.
We've got that recording. Yeah, some commissioners request we decided to set up some workshops with some of the agencies that we work with, DEQ, Water Resources, and Department of Land Conservation and Development. And Water Resources was kind enough to send some staff to us tonight. We have Larry Mantier, who's a Water Resources Manager, currently working on the Josephine County and Jackson County offices. Kathy Smith, who is our Water Master for Josephine County, has joined us. And Ivan Gall, over there in the brown shirt, setting up our recalcitrant computer. He'll be doing a presentation on groundwater. And with that, I'm just going to give the floor over to Larry. And I wanted to ask, they're going to blow through a presentation in about 40 minutes or so, 45 minutes, and have about 15 minutes for Q&A. So if you can hold your questions until then, it would be good. They might be answered as the presentation goes on. Thanks.
Password.
Password.
Do you have a password?
Tachi.
Good evening. I'm Larry Rentier. I'm the Deputy Regional Manager for the Southwest Region. I'm also the Water Master for Jackson County, so I'm kind of wearing two hats. I have 25 years experience in this trade, all of it in Jackson County. Recently, I was promoted to the Deputy Regional Manager to come over to the Grants Pass office and we're kind of restructured. Tonight, who's going to be speaking is Kathy Smith, who's your local Water Master. So we work for the Oregon Water Resources Department. We are the agency that's governed with protecting the resource, both groundwater and surface water, and Kathy will give you more detail on that. Kathy comes to our agency with a bachelor's degree in biology in the University of New Mexico, a master's degree in water resource at the University of New Mexico. She's had a career 3 years in environmental counseling in New Mexico and Montana, 6 months assistant water master in Lane County, and she's been your water master here in Josephine County for 5.5 years, so most of you may know her. Being a water master obviously has a whole array of responsibilities and duties, and the primary responsibility and duty is enforcing Oregon water law. Ivan Gall has been around a long time. He lived in Ashland, got his bachelor's degree from Southern Oregon University in geology, got his master's degree in hydrogeology at Wright State University, 5 years as an environmental consultant, and 13 years for Oregon Water Resources Department, and I believe 10 of those 13 individuals were here in Grants Pass. Pretty close to that. So a lot of you may know Ivan, he's done a lot of public speaking. He has been promoted to a regional manager on the east side of the mountain in Baker City, and currently re-promoted to our groundwater department, so he's a groundwater manager and a regional manager. Our agency, like Deer County's, had quite a few budget hits, and so some of us are wearing two hats to keep the agencies afloat. That is pretty much where I'm going to go with this tonight so that Ivan can get into his presentation and Kathy can get more into what the agency does. We're really here to answer your questions, so we want to get through this quickly so we have plenty of time to answer your questions. Anything you want to ask about water, we're the folks that can answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, good evening, commissioners, gentlemen. A lot of the information I'm going to present tonight is in response to some questions that Dave gave us that he thought would be of interest to you. The first one was, what is the role or responsibility of the Oregon Water Resources Department? So in general, the vision of the Water Resources Department is to assure sufficient and sustainable water supplies that are available to meet current and future needs. Our mission statement is to directly address Oregon's water supply needs and to restore and protect stream flows and watersheds in order to ensure the long-term sustainability of Oregon's ecosystems, economy, and quality of life. That's the last thing I'll read directly off the paper. So one of the questions was, when is a water right needed? So in 1909, when the people of the state voted for the state to take over both tracking and regulating water, at that time, there was information put out that if you had a claim for water, if you had been using it prior to 1909, that you could come in and file a claim. And that would involve what the source was, what you were using it for, where you were using it, and how much you were using it. And then those claims went through an adjudication process. And in the County of Josephine, the surface water rights have been fully adjudicated. So those were rights that occurred prior to 1909. After 1909, if you wanted a water right, you had to go through a three-step process, and you would apply for what you wanted to do, and again, you would be stating those same ideas, what your source was, what you were going to use it for, where you were going to use it, and what the rate was. Then the department, which is now in existence, but prior to that, it was the state engineer who oversaw water resources, would decide if a permit could be issued to do what you said you wanted to do. Once the permit was issued, you had the go-ahead to proceed, and then you would submit what was called a claim of beneficial use. And once our department reviewed that and everything was okay, you would be given a certificate. So there's two kinds of water rights. One are adjudicated rights, and one are the certificated rights that went through the permitting process. So when is a water right needed? The waters belong to the people of the state. And we have a three-point test that we go through when we determine if the situation calls for a water right. The first is to ask, is the source the waters of the state? And the second is to find out if there is some control involved in the activity in terms of diverting the water. And that can mean an actual device, such as a ditch that gets constructed or a head gate, or actually digging a pond where you're going to store and contain water. And then the third part of this was, will the water be put to beneficial use? Meaning, will the applicant get some beneficial use from this water? And if it meets the three-point test, then it requires a water right. I already addressed the process for doing that. You go through the application permit and then certificate. So one of the questions that came up is, what are the water issues in Josephine County? And the biggest issue is availability. All of the streams in Josephine County are fully appropriated when we're talking about streams. The only two places where you can get new water rights in terms of surface water, I'll talk about springs and ponds separately. But if you live on the Applegate River or the Rogue River or have access to those two rivers, there's contract water available. So for the Applegate Reservoir, that's where you get the contract through the Bureau of Reclamation, and that's only to be used for irrigation. And that process is two-part. You get a water right from our department, and you apply for a contract with the Bureau of Reclamation. And right now, there's water available still at the Applegate Reservoir. And then your other option is Lost Creek Reservoir for the Rogue River. So with the Bureau of Reclamation, you can get a contract for irrigation. But what the Corps of Engineer does in terms of water availability off of Lost Creek is they will issue contracts for storage, where you actually buy storage space, and it's for municipal and industrial use. One of the issues along the Rogue River is sometimes there are areas where the wells aren't that great, and so people need water for human consumption. And the way the Corps addresses this is they will not issue a contract to what they call a finite entity, which they say that's what a human being is. But if you form some kind of corporation or association that will continue in perpetuity, you can get a contract with them for human consumption, but the contract is with this entity that will continue. The way they deal with the funding for this is when you get the contract, you are charged what your share of the cost of the dam construction was. So say you're only wanting 1 acre foot, Lost Creek Reservoir is huge, so there's this very small percentage of the cost of the dam construction that you would be charged up front. If the storage space that you're asking for is less than 5 acre feet, they look at, if it were for a bigger amount, you would be getting a monthly bill for the maintenance of the reservoir. But when it's less than 5 acre feet, what they do is they project this cost over 30 years, and you're charged up front for the initial contract fee for the construction of the dam, and then the maintenance and operation costs projected out for 30 years. So at the beginning, there's a one-time fee. The idea is that these contracts are in perpetuity, and so at the end of 30 years, you don't have to pay another contract cost. You just will again pay up front the cost for maintenance and operation. So that's one of the ways that the river water from Lost Creek Reservoir is available for human consumption, along with municipal and industrial uses. When we talk about groundwater, I'm going to address a lot of the issues, but I'll just touch on the groundwater exemption. For every property under one ownership, and this can be either one lot or contiguous lots under one ownership, you get one groundwater exemption. And so the exemption means you can use this groundwater without applying for a water right. And what the exemption is 15,000 gallons a day for domestic use, but that was with the idea that you could have 30 families using this well. The average household uses 200 to 400 gallons per day. There's 5,000 for commercial use, and then you can irrigate up to a half acre of lawn or non-commercial garden. One of the issues that has come up with this groundwater exemption is people will ask if they can use the water for the commercial exemption for irrigating plants, and the answer is no. The fact that you can irrigate up to a half acre of lawn or non-commercial garden is the only part of that exemption that's for irrigation for watering plants.
Excuse me, can I ask, well, then what's the 15,000 gallons?
For domestic use, so that would be like in your household, drinking, bathing, washing the dog, your washer and dryer.
15,000 gallons a day.
But that's what the idea could be for 30 families. It's always without waste, and so you use what you need to use without wasting the water, but up to 15,000 gallons a day. Did that answer the question?
Yes, thanks.
Okay, I'm just going to address applications for new groundwater rights. One of the other issues that we deal with in this county frequently because of the abundance of rural areas in Josephine County is the issue of springs. So we look at springs in two different ways. We have what we call exempt springs, and then there are springs that require a water right. So if a spring arises on your property, and just to clarify what a spring is, because there's often an issue of semantics, people will say there's underground springs. But a spring is water that comes from under the ground and flows above the surface. So if you're talking below the surface, you're talking groundwater. So a spring has to flow above the surface of the ground. So when a spring is exempt is when you have this water flowing on your property and it ends somewhere before it goes into a channel that carries water off of the property or flows into another channel that goes off the property. So I'm going to say that a little differently. The concept is that if it is not exempt, it means that you have so much of a flow that it's created a channel to move the water beyond your property. If it's exempt, it means it stops somewhere. That you could have a small channel, but it's not going to exit your property. And so with the springs, what happens is people will call me and say, I think I have an exempt spring. So then I go out to the property, and sometimes the spring will start off with a drainage below it, but I'll usually walk those out. And if it comes to an area that has flattened out with what I know to be upland plants, you've definitely lost this drainage, and so even though it might start off with one, it can end up being exempt. And so I usually walk these drainages to see where it ends up. Then I'll write a letter that I ask you to keep with your papers for your house, saying you have an exempt spring, and we keep one on file in our office. The other thing I ask is that people don't develop these springs before I come out, because once they start digging into the ground and put in a spring box, when I come out, frequently I'm no longer seeing water flowing above the ground surface. And what they end up having is a groundwater collection system. And then we're back to the exemption for groundwater in terms of use. So again, on the issues of Josephine County in terms of water, there are other issues that are dealt with other agencies. DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, deals with water quality. We don't. Department of Fish and Wildlife deals with fish habitat issues with water. So again, the biggest issue is availability, the fact that all the streams are fully appropriated, which takes me to storage. So when someone applies for water for storage or any kind of water right application, we look at a water availability model. And that tells us what the average stream flows are in that creek, how much water has already been given out in terms of water rights, and what's available for new water rights. Frequently during the winter months when we have the most precipitation, there will be some water for storage, but that's on a case-by-case basis. So if someone wants a pond application, I'll have them come in and I'll check the water availability. So say you're out on Jump Off Joe Creek and there's water available during the months of January, February, and March. You get your permit to construct your pond, but you have to include in the structure some system that will carry water around that pond outside of those months when water is available. And the other half of this is you can apply for a secondary water right to use the water from that pond, say, for irrigation later on in the year. Those ponds, when you get the water right, it's a one-time fill. So say it's filled up during the winter, you used it for irrigation, now it's raining later on. Again, you're held to those months when it fills up. I think that's all I'm going to cover. If you have any questions on what I just covered, you can go ahead as long as it's not groundwater, because Ivan will take care of that.
Did you say we're over-appropriated or under-appropriated across all systems?
And again, that's a matter of semantics. The fact that I regulate off Williams Creek in most years, you could say we were over-appropriated on Williams Creek, because what happens is we're a prior appropriation state, so in times of shortage, the person with the oldest water right can make a call for water, and there are water rights out on Williams Creek for 1858. So last week, the person that manages the ditch that had the 1858 water rights made a call for water, and I went out, and luckily I was able just to regulate off people back to 1900. And that gave the people with the 1858 water right enough water to keep irrigating. So in that sense, in times of shortage, sometimes we are over-appropriated.
There's a major change in when COPCO came with the power. The old water rights were based on flood irrigation. Today, most farmers, for example, and others irrigate with sprinklers. Isn't there a major change in that early right that was based on flood irrigation versus the amount of use they have on the same acreage?
If I'm understanding you correctly, I'll explain it this way. So with a water right, you're given a rate of how much water you can divert in, say, gallons per minute or cubic feet per second. If you're growing alfalfa and you're flood irrigating, You usually have some idea of how much water you're using with a sprinkler system. You have a better idea of how much water you're using, and it will take less water. What our department does in terms of that, if someone would file a complaint and say that you are now no longer using the rate that you're entitled to, it could be a partial cancellation of that water right. I've never seen that happen. The other part of this is we have a conservation plan where a landowner could come to us and say, hey, I used to flood irrigate, now I'm sprinkler irrigating, I'm saving this much water. And what we'll say to them is you can take a portion of the amount that you saved and add it to an additional land use, but we get a portion of that to put it back into the stream for ecology and fish. So that's one of the advantages of going to a more effective system, that's the litter conservation program.
Go ahead, Dave.
The last thing you touched on, was seasonal streams. So seasonal streams are regulated, even though they're not they may just be dry in the summertime.
Right. All of the water in Oregon belongs to the public. And so you have the groundwater exemption, and then with surface water, other than exempt springs, everything requires a water right. So even a raindrop that hits the ground and flows over the soil, if you're going to capture that, you need a water
right. If I wanted to do a pond, I'd have to come to you, even though it doesn't flow all year.
Right, right. The one thing I didn't mention is the one way you can use water without getting a permit is through a rainwater collection system. So if you collect rainwater from an impervious surface like your roof or asphalt into a storage tank prior to it touching soil, then you can use that water for whatever you want. So there are a few people in this area who have some very efficient rainwater collection systems.
Question. Are you a referring agency? Do you get referrals from the planning department, like the land development?
Definitely.
And you comment on them?
I sign off on almost everything that comes through the planning department.
And you alert us as to areas that might be short on water and water supply?
Occasionally, I have looked at the well information that the groundwater department has collected. If there's an area of concern, Jen Woody is the hydrogeologist that covers this area, so if there's a question, I'll call her and she'll take over. So she's the specialist for groundwater in this area.
Thanks. Hey, Kathy, I'm not sure if your office is still doing overstation water well tests, well pump tests.
No.
Well, nobody is, I guess.
No, actually, Ivan will address that. There's a county ordinance that covers it. Okay. Thank you.
Hi, folks. I've got my notes here on sheets, so you don't have to spend too much time writing. I appreciate the opportunity to come down and speak with you folks. I'm going to move pretty quickly and hope that we'll have a few minutes left at the end for questions. I won't hesitate to stop me while I'm talking if you have questions. As Larry said, I spent some time here in Grants Pass. For about 9 years, I was a Southwest Region hydrogeologist. So I dealt with a lot of groundwater issues in Wilson County, spent a lot of time with the planning department and the planning commission over the last 4 years. I've been in Baker City, so prior to that. I wanted to touch real quickly on the general hydrogeology. So that's kind of the physical groundwater sense that folks as wells develop water from here in Josephine County. I'm going to go ahead and use the PowerPoint presentation for this. What you're looking at here is a simplified map of the geology of Josephine County. The yellow are what we call quaternary sediments. So these are recent sand and gravel deposits. Rogue River coming through Grants Pass here and cutting north. You can see the recent deposits there. Big thickness of them out here in the Illinois Basin from the Illinois River. See how they point to one. Sorry. Yeah, so the quaternary sediments here in the yellow again, Rogue River coming through here. Illinois Basin had a lot of the sediments there. And then Williams Creek and the Applegate coming through here where we find most. The gray splotches here are the granitic sediments. And they're in a couple of different what we call blue tongs. This is Williams. And then some more granitic off to the west there. Those granitics are fractured bedrock, solid rock, and permeability, nothing. The only water that exists in that are in the fracture systems themselves. So the best scenario I can give you is if you take a 5 gallon bucket filled with sand, that's kind of synonymous with the alluvial aquifer. You can store a lot of water in there, you can move a lot of water through that stuff. Fill that 5 gallon bucket with concrete, let it harden, and then smash it with a sledgehammer. You fracture it, but you can see that you're not going to store much water in there. And if you don't drill into those fractures, your well is basically going to be a dry hole. The rest of Josephine County are kind of these blues, and that's the bulk of the area landmass. And we've just compiled that into kind of a metamorphic terrain. It's a very, very complex assemblage of what we call sedimentary rocks, old sandstone shales, clays, things like that, volcanic rocks. They've all been squeezed, folded, faulted, mashed together, and have very low permeability in general. They have water quality concerns in general.
And so for domestic well yields, it's even questionable whether you can get enough water in those areas to survive a single home or a group of small homes. And you can see that that's in most parts of the bulk of the county. Fortunately for us, in a lot of cases, a lot of the development corridors have been either on the granitics or along the so that's pretty much the geology there. Groundwater issues and limitations. Josephine County, back in the day, was very, very progressive and proactive. They had their own water resources department. The funding was available. And so a lot of studies got done that occurred here that didn't really occur elsewhere in the state. It was recognized 20, 30 years ago that portions of Josephine County had occurrences of salt water, saline water. So the county did studies and tried to help define that. I worked with a geologist from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries several years ago trying to help further refine that and figure out where some of these occurrences are and then why they occur. And, you know, our study showed that they were usually associated with areas of low permeability, so faulting dikes, bedrock contacts between some of these units out here. Saline water then can be an issue for the overlying area of Fruitdale Creek, Lower River Road below town here, and then Selma has occurrences of it, fairly shallow out there, that folks are aware of, and certainly as you go in to develop new areas, they need to be aware of that. Salinity, the only way you can deal with it is either dilution or reverse osmosis. Other issues out there that we got called into all the time, well maintenance, folks drill a well, they expect that well to be good for the rest of their lives, certainly that's not the case. Seasonal well interference is an issue that we would run into oftentimes. So during the summer months, as folks increase their groundwater usage for outside irrigation, one well can start impacting the yield of another well. Those are often kind of difficult to document. I'll get into that here in a little bit. Long-term water level decline. Let's see. Go to the next slide here. Up there is where we see the typical mining of the resource. We're actually pulling out more water annually than is recharged. And with time, water level starts to decline. We have one maybe occurrence of that here in the county, so that luckily hasn't been a big issue to date. And then we talked about areas of low yield where some of these metamorphic rocks or even the granitic aquifer is so low and it's difficult to improve those even by going deep. Around Josephine County, we have collected a lot of water level data over the years. Red dots scattered here indicate what we call current observation wells. So those are the wells that we still measure the water level in today. The other dots, and they don't show up so well here, kind of the lighter blues, those were wells where we have historical records that. And I'll just run you through a couple of them real quick. Next slide, please. Just being 1803 up there in the Wolf Creek area here, this is a low yield bedrock, so it's in the metamorphic rock. The well was drilled 57 feet. Back in 1990, we started collecting data on this well through currents, and you can see the steep water level fluctuations where during the recharge season, the water level is nearly at land surface, at land surface on one occasion here. And then as the dry season comes on, it'll drop 10 to 15 feet normally. This was probably a result of pump. But nothing really too exciting here. Seasonal fluctuations, 10, 15 feet. Water levels are basically steady. So that's what we like to see. It's a good, healthy resource, if you will, where the water groundwater use in that area is being replenished every year by the guy. This well here is located in the Merlin area. So this is in the Grants Pass Pluton here. The granitic aquifer, the well is 200 feet deep. You can see here the depth to water is about 30 feet below land surface. Fluctuates about 10 feet every year, and again, relatively constant. You don't see a lot of big spikiness from wet years or big decline in dry years in the system. You know, 2002 was a real dry year. Yeah, didn't quite recharge fully, but you're talking one or two. Right here in Grants Pass, so we're south of the river now. Next slide. This is one of the wells that Roe Community College uses, and this is the one I alluded to a little bit ago that shows maybe something of a long-term decline, again, starting in 1990 through 2006, you know, water levels appear to have a bit of a downward trend. where the lows are getting lower and the seasonal highs are recovering as high as the previous years there. But then in 06, we saw a pretty good recharge here and then a little bit more. That should be an indication of some overdevelopment in the granitic aquifer in that area. How far that stands out, we don't know. Yes?
What's the blue line on that map?
The blue line, I'm not sure what that is. I think it's just got, we had several water levels, several wells at RCC that we recorded. So, again, though, you can see depth of water here, about 50 feet, going down to 60 feet below land, but superimposed on that, possibly a longer term. Pop out to the Illinois Basin here. Next slide. So this is an alluvial well in what we call the basin fill materials, some sand and gravels out there, 104 drilled in the late 90s. Water level about 12 feet below land surface, dropping down to 17, 18 feet there. A little bit noisier in some of these years, and that's not too legal for sand and gravel wells where when you get a really wet year with a very repulsive recharge from an unusual well. So, we've kind of talked about the hydrogeology there and a little bit about the well yields and well construction. One of the things Dave asked that I touched on was the demonstration of residential water availability. How do you folks know when somebody comes in with a subdivision proposal, a land partition proposal, is it a good idea to go forward from a water perspective? Josephine County, I may still on the books as the Article 84 of the County Development Code. That's a series of articles that the county has that requires, under certain circumstances, pump tests, what we call aquifer tests. And depending on the scale of the project, it scales up or down those pump tests accordingly. It's probably the best way to gather data for a particular area for the groundwater availability. You pump a well, you measure the water level recovery in that well. You also go measure water level recovery in the surrounding wells that are available. And you get a sense as to how good is that resource to provide a certain amount of water for the proposed development there. You know, the county lost staff back in 2003, 2004. I don't know that that Article 84 has been exercised very much at all. The county just doesn't have the professional hydrogeologists, basically, or geologists to do it. The geology that we just talked about is a good way to get a general sense of how big the groundwater resource is going to be in an area. Are these folks on granite or are they on the metamorphics? You can also look at water well log data on our webpage. What other wells in the area tell you? You know, if you start seeing tax logs with two wells, three wells, four wells on them, that's a pretty clear indication that you know, the resource isn't very good. One of the questions that came up were old pump tests or aquifer tests, do data is used today for decisions? And they can be. The water level data we looked at here tonight didn't show a lot of long-term decline. So I expect you know, the groundwater resource on the granitic pluton to be generally as robust as it was 10 years ago, maybe 20 years ago. And there may be isolated differences where that isn't the case. But if you've got an aquifer test for an area that was done 10 years ago, it's probably reasonable to go ahead and extrapolate it to the next parcel over and say, yeah, you know, this showed it was pretty good. We think fairly good over there if all things are the same. The problem with geology is there's no guarantee that the conditions on tax lot A are going to be comparable to the conditions on tax lot B. Any questions so far?
Is the major source of recharge to the groundwater basin rivers, river beds? There are, in other words, there are no man-made percolation ponds, per se?
None that I'm aware of that are set out intentionally for that purpose. You know, the general hydrologic model, and I'm sure you guys have seen it in the past, rain and snow falling in the mountains, and some of that flows off into the rivers and recharges the surface water system. Some of it percolates down into the aquifers, and some of that percolation very quickly pops back up into a creek and then flows off. Some of it makes it deeper into the flow system. And so you can go down here along the Rogue River
And because the Rogue River is a major stream basin, or major stream in this basin, we look at that as kind of the bottom of the flow system. So that is where all groundwater is trying to discharge to. We're not aware of any underground rivers from Crater Lake to your well, for example. It's all generally localized. But there are some very long flow paths, and as you get down towards the Rogue River, some of the deeper wells have encountered saline water, some of them actually fairly shallow, where this very deep, very old groundwater is trying to come up and discharge into that stream. And so again, in areas where you wouldn't expect to find salinity, you know, next to a big river with a lot of fresh water there, you do. And so an understanding of the type of geology can be very, very important there. There were some folks on Little River Road 10 years ago or so that were drilling a well for a new home, and hit 4 or 5 gallons at 300 feet when it went down to 600 feet in the granite, which is generally good water quality, and hit 100 gallons a minute of water that was so saline they couldn't use it, so they had to go ahead and pump cement off the bottom of the hole before trying to manage it. So the geology in Southern Oregon is very complex. You can have some gross generalizations of what you're going to run into, but it really is a lot of times site-specific, particularly if you're going with deeper wells there.
We had a land use application a couple of years ago where he hired a local geotech firm, and he analyzed the watershed area and estimated it permitted flow into the ground. I can't think of the word. And or made a so forth decided it was enough to handle the subdivision of the country. But it didn't address the areas surrounding wells, which were like 1 gallon per minute median flow. And apparently, we're not required to even look at that, but it would be smart to do so. We had this argument about whether you can really tell what the effect would be. The environment was, if you can tell what's going to be on the, you know, the site, or the water development, you should be able to tell on the neighboring site as well, if it's on the same island where it's water together. But I can't talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as a hydrogeologist, I'm going to take a look at all the available data that's out there. You know, we start with topographic maps, look at elevation changes, you can look at soils, you know, coming south on I-5, off of Sexton there, you can look at Red Mountain. There's not a lot of vegetation there. Why is that? Serpentine is kind of the worst of metamorphic rock. Really rich in iron and magnesium and manganese, so a lot of plants don't like it. That's an indication that tells you something. And you want to look at all of those things, and particularly well logs in the area. And if you're lucky, when you're trying to assess, you know, the potential of finding groundwater on a parcel, you'll have other well logs in the area. Those will provide the best information out there. In some cases, though, the land is far enough away from other well logs that it's hard to extrapolate with much confidence what the site conditions are going to be. In that situation, the best thing you can do is go ahead and drill a well, and those aren't cheap to do, and that sort of thing. But, you know, as a homeowner and a groundwater user in Oregon, you want to proceed slowly because building a home is an expensive endeavor, and I've seen many folks end up with inadequate water supplies where they pour everything they own into a home, a retirement home, their little slab of heaven, and it's heartbreaking to see these folks basically struggle. Let's figure out how we can buy a truck and start hauling water to some of these residences on that. So luckily those cases tend to be few and far between, but when they do occur, it's very, very difficult for folks to remedy that situation.
One of the things on the Planning Commission that we hear a lot when looking at approvals for these small subdivisions or even individual lots, they always say, well, if they build a septic tank, you know, they're going to impact my well. Can you comment on that? We hear that almost every week, that if you build a septic tank, you're going to ruin my well.
Okay. Oregon today has really good standards for both septic system design and installation and maintenance, and well construction and design. And today, depending on which comes first, the septic or the well, we look at it from the well perspective. The well has to be located at least 50 feet from the septic tank and 100 feet from the ground. If people mess that up, we'll make the driller or the landowner abandon the well in order to remedy that situation. I get it right the first time. DEQ will call us and say, hey, the well was there, the guy inadvertently installed the septic system too close to the well. Well, that's now more of a DEQ issue, and they have ways to deal with that. But none of these fixes are cheap.
So, but the standards that are out there today, I would have zero concern with a properly constructed well and a properly sited and constructed septic system without groundwater contamination from the septic system. There could be areas that just have contaminated groundwater. I'm familiar with one well out Lower River Road. They drilled a brand new well and they could not get it to pass the coliform bacteria test. And all visible signs, it looked like it had been properly constructed, but it was in the middle of a horse pasture in a wet, boggy area. So for drinking water wells, you know, the drinking water section with Department of Health sets up safe drinking water perimeters, and they're there for a reason. You want to try and keep nasty stuff away from your wellhead. We try and do as much outreach as we can with landowners one-on-one. You know, next to the well in the well house is not a good place to store your herbicides and pesticides.
So assuming that the setbacks are met, there also is not really any issue with uphill downhill. We hear that one too. They're going to build a septic tank uphill from my well.
Yeah, the systems should be designed to handle that and accommodate that. And, you know, my septic system has to be 100, my drain field has to be 100 feet away from not only my well, but your well, all of them.
Sure.
And so, you know, if that spacing is there, there should be sufficient spacing to provide the necessary treatment, you know, to take care of it. We can sit here and speculate about weird hydrogeological situations where that won't be the case. But, you know, the norm is, you know, they're very protective. And that stands out to me. You know, we've got thousands of septic systems in Josephine County, thousands of wells, and very few of them come in with call.
The other thing, if I can add something, I would do to the normal, is we have well construction inspectors. The state is responsible for monitoring the drilling of a well, and that's what protects you from having that pollution reach into your well. They have to be lined or sealed and cased down to a certain depth depending on the formation they go through. So we are responsible, we being the agency, to make sure that the drillers drill the wells to our state code.
Okay, what's the process to drill a well on private property? Landowner generally is going to contract with a licensed bonded water driller, water well driller. There is an opportunity for a landowner to drill their own well under a landowner permit and bond. It's not done very frequently, particularly around here. The water well constructor will file a start card with our agency, so that's a notice of intent to begin construction on a well. Our well inspector that Larry just mentioned will take a look at that and try and get out while they're constructing the well or afterwards to do the inspection on that. And following completion of the well, the well driller then will file a well construction log with our agency. They have 30 days to do that after completion. So within 30 days of completion of the well, there will be a public record there that's available for everybody to look at on the internet as to how that well was drilled, who was the owner at the time, the tax lot. Sometimes they'll put the lat long on there for GPS. So it's a fairly transparent process. Resolving disputes between well owners, what we call kind of a well interference case or well interference issue. We will oftentimes get a call from a landowner who is concerned that their well may be impacted. They're actually quite certain that their well is impacted from the neighbor's well. And so what we will do is kind of start a paper research. We'll look at the tax lot information, ownership information, pull up well logs in the area. If we're lucky, we can find both well logs that are in question. And then, and Kathy will usually be the person, or Alan Omi, our well inspector here, doing that kind of background research. And then depending on what they find, they'll call a hydrogeologist in our Salem office who will take a look at it from a technical perspective and try and figure out, gosh, what kind of an aquifer are they in? Is it likely that these could be interfering with one another? You know, the driller logged a quarter gallon a minute on this one guy's well. Is that really the reason he's complaining? Did he ever really have any water? And so, at some point in time, if it's justified, we'll go out to the site, locate the wells, get GPS locations on them, measure the water levels in each well, and start comparing those. If the water levels between the two wells are drastically different, and they haven't been pumped, say, in 8 or 10 hours, then that tells us right away that there's some sort of an issue going on. If the water levels are in the same aquifer, that the water levels, what we call the hydraulic heads, will be very similar, particularly across the fence where these cases occur. So we'll pull all that information together, and if it looks like there could be an interference issue, then we'll actually turn on one well and measure water levels in the other well. And that'll tell us right then and there what's going on. It takes a lot of staff time and a lot of resources to do that. So we try and resolve these things over the phone as best we can.
I mean, how long does it take for it to show up between one well and another? I suppose it depends on the formation and the distance.
It depends on the aquifer. Go back to my scenario, a 5-gallon bucket filled with sand or gravel. That system stores a lot of water. So when you're in an aquifer like that and you turn on a pump, that cone of depression doesn't spread out very quickly. That's fairly slow. It may be very shallow. 100 feet away, it may not even be measurable. Because keep in mind, most domestic wells are pumping 5, maybe 10, maybe 15 gallons a minute. They're not high-yield wells because folks don't want to pay for the big pumps. In a fractured bedrock system, that's what we call more confined, so it's under pressure. If two wells are in the same fracture system, that pumping response from one well to the other will be almost immediate and can be very drastic, because there's very little water stored in those fracture systems. It depends on the situation there. That's kind of what we have to go out and study there. Oftentimes, let me say that a different way, it's very rare that we find a well interference issue where one well has the potential to significantly interfere with another well. Usually what we find is that someone has a poor yielding well. I've gone in their houses and it's like, yeah, the toilet's running. And so, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they're losing a gallon and a half of water down the toilet. When you only got 2 gallons a minute, that's significant. And they start, a lot of times, again, back to people's expectation that their wells are always going to be perfect, their wells fail, their pumps fail. I had a guy call me, his well got hot all of a sudden, and he was concerned about, volcanism in the area. And I was concerned, that's going to be a good one. But it turns out that the decomposed granite falling into his well had worn the stainless steel impellers on his pump. And he was pumping furiously with this little nub. And the only water that got by the motor was heating up from the pump motor. And that's what was creating the problem. So, you know, a new pump. $600 later, he was good to go again. But the well maintenance is very important for folks who go long term. So that's all I have. I want to leave some time, a little bit of time for questions. I'm more than happy to come down anytime and get into any of these topics in more detail. We can talk geology until you're all nodding your heads, or groundwater hydraulics, anything you want to do, but I want to make sure you get your questions answered. And we're here for a resource. Kathy wanted me to touch on new groundwater rights. Fairly straightforward process, pretty hard to get. Anytime a well is going to be connected to surface water, you heard the surface water is fully appropriated today. We can't allow any more interference in groundwater pumping on those. So folks that want to have a little 5-acre mini pony farm, unless they can get more than a quarter mile or better yet more than a mile away from surface water, the best they're likely going to be able to come up with is that 1/2-acre exemption for lawn non-commercial yards. Yes?
Do you have a phone number we can reach you at?
I do. I will pass out some cards here real quick and get that for you.
You give a pretty positive report of our water situation, I think. I know I've talked to you before, and I believe you told me and other folks that as long as the lots weren't split up smaller than 5 acres, probably most areas in Josephine County weren't going to be over-appropriated. You still feel that way?
I think that's fair. There are areas where you can go smaller than that, but just crude Ivan's back-of-the-envelope estimate, you know, 5 acres is probably a safe bet for all the areas that I've seen. You know, that being said, I've seen guys with 5, 10, 20-acre parcels with 7 wells on them, and you just can't get anything. Okay. And that's not a function of overdevelopment or anything. That's just the poor geology that they're stuck with.
So you don't think we have any programs we need to start to try to protect ourselves in the future from overallocation, as long as we don't start to put a lot smaller than 5 acres?
Yeah.
I'll hold it to that.
And I think one of the issues you want to keep in mind is the 5-acre parcels that you're talking about. If they're wanting to do what Ivan mentioned, this hobby farm or horses and pasture, and now they're wanting to apply for a groundwater right, and they've got a seasonal creek or something of that nature within that quarter mile, half mile, mile range,
then they aren't getting, they're not going to be able to develop the property the way that they really want to. So they need to have a clear understanding. You get the exemption that Kathy talked about, the half-acre long garden, with the likelihood of being able to expand that, unless you're along the main river where you can purchase food, it's going to be slim to none. So there's a lot of strict rules out there, our Division 9 rules. I even could come to that. Basically, it's the hydraulic connection between surface water and groundwater that we have to protect. Anything else for us?
Any other questions?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity to come down.
Thanks to Larry, Kathy, and Ivan for your
presentation.
Okay, we've got 6 minutes until the meeting starts.